big as a hill, and I couldn't see over it. I'd call out, "Are you still back there?" Holler to me. Like most fat Indians, he did have a skinny butt. Man, those muscles in his back cheeks were powerful, too. He swung me around like a circus act, so I enjoyed him real well. Those times were good. "Awee," said Mushum. His voice was wistful. "But sadly, they were not to last," said Grandma Ignatia. "One time we were going hell for leather when he quit. Sometimes he did get tired out, of course, being so heavy like he was. So I just keep cranking away on top. His flagpole was still up and hard as steel. But I thought he might have gone to sleep, he was so quiet. Holler to me," I said. "But he never did. My, it's strange he sleeps through all of this. He must be having a grand dream, I think. So I don't quit until it's all over. Many times over with me. At last I get off him. My, he's lasting, I think. I crawl around to the other end of him, not long, and I realize that he is not breathing. I pat his face, but no good. He is dead and gone. My sweet, fat husband. I mourn for that man a solid year." "Ah, oui," said Mushum, "a happy death, and a noble lover for you, Ignatia. As he satisfied you even from the other side. I wish to die that way, but who will give me the chance?" "Does it still stand up?" asked Ignatia. "Not by itself," said Mushum. "Aye," said Ignatia. "After 100 years of hard use, it would be a miracle. If you only prayed more," she cackled. Mushum's frail shoulders were shaking. "Pray for a hard-on. That's a good one. Maybe I should pray to St. Joseph. He was a carpenter and worked with wood. Them nuns never mentioned the patron saint of Mana." Mushum said, "I will say a prayer to St. Jude, the one who handles lost cases. And I will pray to St. Anthony, the one in charge of lost objects. You're so old you probably can't even find your own pecker in those pants Clements put on you today." "Yes, these pants, they are good material." "One of my other husbands," said Ignatia, "the one with the tiny cock, had a pair of pants like yours once. Extremely high quality. He had sex like a rabbit. Quick in out, but for hours at a time. I would just lay there making things up in my head, thinking my own thoughts. It was restful. I felt nothing. Then one day something. Oh, what? I cried. What happened to you? Did it grow? Yes, I watered it," he said, "between in out, and fertilized it." "Yay," I cried out, even louder. "What did you use?" "I'm joking, woman. I made it bigger with clay from the river." "Oh, no." All of a sudden, I felt nothing again. "It fell off," he said. "The whole weenog?" "No, just the clay part." He was very downhearted. "Oh, my love," he said. "I wanted to make you scream like a bobcat. I'd give my life to make you happy." I said to him, "That's all right. I'll show you another way." So I showed him a thing or two, and he learned so good that I made sounds his ears had never heard. One time, anyway, we had this lantern swinging from a hook over the foot of the bed. He was going at me like the rabbit, and that lantern fell off the hook and hit him in the ass. I heard him tell his friends about it. They were laughing pretty good. Then he says, "I was lucky, though. If I had been doing the deed my old lady taught me, the one that makes her so happy? That lantern would have hit me in the head. Yai! Musham's tea spluttered from his lips. I gave him a napkin because Clements had also charged me with keeping food out of his hair, which, against her wishes, he'd worn the way he liked it, hanging down around his face in greasy strands. Too bad we never tried each other out when we were young, said Ignatia. You are much too shriveled up to suit me now, but as I remember it, you were damn good-looking. So I was, said Musham. I blotted away the tea that was rolling down his neck before it reached the starched white collar of his shirt. I drove a few girls out of their minds, Musham continued, but when my pretty wife was leaving, I did my Catholic duty. No difficulty there, Ignatius snorted. Were you faithful or not? They both pronounced the word faithful. In fact, every TH in this whole conversation was a T. I was faithful, said Musham, to a point. What point? Said Ignatius sharply. She always supported women's extramarital excitements, but was completely intolerant of men's. Oh, wait, my old friend. How could I be forgetting? To a point. Aye! Very funny. Anisha Indina. Yes, of course. She lived out on the point, that Lulu. And you had your son with her? I started in surprise, but neither one of them noticed. Was it known all over that I had an uncle I never knew about? Who was this son of Musham's? I tried to shut my mouth, but as I looked around, I saw, of course, a large number of guests were Lamartines and Morrisseys, and then Ignatius said his name. That Elvin did good for himself. Elvin, a friend of Whitey's. Elvin had always seemed like part of the family. Well, when I tell this story to white people, they are surprised, and when I tell it to Indians, they always have a story like it. And they usually found out about their relatives by dating the wrong ones. Or at any rate, they usually began to figure out family somewheres in their teens. Maybe it was because no one thought to explain the obvious, which was always there. Or maybe as a child I just had not listened before. Anyway, I now realize that Angus was some kind of cousin to me, as Star was a Morrissey, and her sister, mother to Angus, was once married to Elvin's younger brother, Vance. And yet as Vance had a different father from Elvin, the connection was weakened. Had I heard the name for this type of cousin? I wondered, sitting there. Or should I ask Musham and Ignatia? Excuse me, I said. Oh yes, my boy, how polite you are. Grandma Ignatia suddenly noticed me sitting there and stuck me with her crow-sharp eyes. If Elvin is my half-uncle and Star's sister was married to Vance, and they had Angus, what does that make Angus to me? Marriageable, croaked Grandma Ignatia. Anisha Indina. Kidding, my boy. You could marry Angus's sister, but you ask a good question. He is your quarter cousin, Musham said firmly. You don't treat him like a whole cousin, but he's closer to you than a friend. You would defend him, but not to the death. That's how he said it, not death. Nowadays, most of us will say our THs, unless we grew up speaking Chippewa. But we still drop a lot of them from habit. My father felt that as a judge, it was important to pronounce his every last D-H. My mother didn't, however. As for me, I left my D's behind when I went to college, and I took up the T-H. So did lots of other Indians. I wrote an awful poem once about all the D's that got left behind and floated around on reservations, and a friend read it. She thought there was something to that idea. And as she was a linguistics major, she wrote a paper on the subject. Several years after she wrote the paper, I married her. back on the reservation, and I noticed that as soon as we passed the line, we dropped our THs and picked up our Ds again. But even though she was a linguistics major, she didn't have a word for what kind of cousin Angus was to me. I thought Musham defined it best with his statement that I was bound to defend Angus, but only so far. I didn't have to die for him, which was a relief. At this point, more people came and sat with us, a crowd, in fact, all around Musham, and the whole party directed its attention to where he sat underneath the arbor. People with cameras carefully positioned themselves, and my mother and Clements posed for pictures with their heads on either side of Musham's head. Then Clements ran back into the house, and there was a hush broken by the exclamations of small children pushed to the edge of the crowd. "The cake! The cake!" As Clements and Edward were now fiddling with their cameras, my cousins Joseph and Evie got to carry in the extraordinary cake. Clements had constructed a great sheet cake frosted with whiskey-laced sugar, Musham's favorite. And she had iced it onto a piece of masonite covered with tinfoil. The cake was the size of a desktop, elaborately lettered with Musham's name and studded with at least 100 candles, already lighted, brightly burning as my cousins walked gingerly forward. People parted around them. I slipped aside once they held the cake right in front of Musham's face. The cake was dazzling. Ignatia looked jealous. The little flames reflected up into Musham's dim old eyes as people sang the happy birthday song in Ojibwe and English, and then started on a Michif tune. The candles flared more intensely as they burned down, dripping wax onto the frosting, until they were mere stubs. "Blow them out! Make a wish!" people cried. But Musham seemed mesmerized by their light. Grandma Ignatia leaned over and spoke right into his ear. He nodded, finally, and stooped over the cake. And at that moment, a stray breeze came through the arbor, a little gust. You think it would have extinguished the candles, but on the contrary, it gave them enough oxygen for one last flare. And when this happened, the little flames fused into a single fire that ignited the mixture of wax and whiskey icing. The cake caught fire with a gentle whoosh, and the flames leapt high enough to ravel into Musham's locks of greasy hair as he bent over with his lips pursed. I still have the picture in my mind of Musham's head surrounded by the blaze. Only his delighted eyes and happy grin showed, as it seemed he was consumed. My grandfather and the cake might have been destroyed right there if Uncle Edward hadn't had the presence of mind to empty a pitcher of lemonade over Musham's head. Just as providentially, Joseph and Evelina were still holding on to the masonite and ran the burning cake out onto the driveway where the flames went out once they had consumed the licorice frosting. Uncle Edward was again the hero of the day as he simply slicked off the scorched frosting with a long bread knife. He declared the rest of the cake edible, indeed, improved by the scorching. Someone brought gallons of ice cream, and the party recommenced. I was told to take Musham inside to rest from the thrill. Once there, Clements tried to cut away his singed locks. The fire itself hadn't touched his skin or his scalp, but to be on fire had excited him enormously. He was concerned that Clements cut away only what parts of his hair were hopelessly black and shriveled. "Okay, I'm trying, Daddy, but the pieces stink, you know." She gave up. "Oh, here, Joe, you sit with him." He was lying on the couch, pillowed, covered with an afghan. Just a pile of sticks and a big grin. His white choppers had come loose in the excitement. So I fetched a cup of water and he plunged them in. Unfortunately, I chose an opaque plastic cup of the kind that children were using to drink Kool-Aid. While my back was turned, some 4-year-old snatched the cup and ran outside happily drinking the denture water, imitating his older cousins, until apparently this child asked his mother for more Kool-Aid, and she saw what was in the bottom. I sat by Mushum, though, oblivious of these dramas. My cousins were home, but much older than me, and absorbed in carrying out constant orders from their mother. My friends, who had promised to come, weren't here yet. This party would go on and on. There would be dancing later, fiddles, an electric guitar and keyboard, more food. My friends were probably waiting for Elvin's pit barbecued venison, or the food coming from their own households. Once a party like this started on the reservation, it always gained its own life. There was a tradition of the uninvited showing up, and every party had provisions for that, as well as for those who would show up drunk and get too rowdy. But from all of this, lying in state on the living room couch, Mushum was protected. Part of things, but able to snooze. I sat with him as he dropped off and slept. But when Sonya entered, he snapped too like a soldier. Her outfit must have penetrated his unconscious. She wore a shirt of softly fringed suede that clung to her breasts like an unforgiven sin. And those jeans, making her legs so long and lean, my eyes popped. New lizard skin trimmed cowboy boots. And she wore those studs in her ears. They trembled in the soft light. I ducked when she tried to kiss the top of my head, moved off so she could sit in my chair, but stayed in the room with my arms folded, glaring at her. I knew that shirt was bought with my doll money, and it looked expensive. She used a lot of my money again, and those boots? Everybody had to notice. Sonya bent close to Mushum. They were speaking in annoying, low voices, and she was shaking her head, laughing. He was giving her a toothless, pleading look that dripped with besotted admiration. She leaned over and kissed his cheek. Then she held his hand and talked some more, and both of them laughed and laughed themselves silly until I got disgusted and went away. My parents were sitting in the grown-up seating area beneath the arbor, and my mother, though talking a little, was at least nodding as my father spoke to her. The band was setting up out by the storage shed. Behind the shed, Whitey and the other drinkers were sitting on the ground passing a bottle. Whitey was on a morose jag now. He sat in the corner of the yard staring at the party, trying to track things with his double vision, muttering dark thoughts that fortunately were completely incoherent. I saw Doe LaFrenay and Cappy's Aunt Josie. There was Star and Zach's mom, too, and Zach's baby brother and sister, but no Zach, Angus, or Cappy. I didn't want to ask where they were in case they were up to something, so I got my bike from beside the garage and I left. I was pretty sure that Zelia had something to do with Cappy's absence. And sure enough, as I went toward the church, I met Zach and Angus zigzagging down the hill. Slow as they could, no Cappy. He stayed behind. They're going to meet in the graveyard at dark, said Zach. All three of us were crushed by the thought, even though we'd given up on Zelia day one. We rode back to the party, which was ramping up with Jiggers stepping out onto the grass and Grandma Ignatia in the middle showing off her fancy steps. We ate as much as we could, then sneaked beers and poured the beer into empty soda cans. We drank and hung out listening to the band, watching Whitey hang on Sonya as they two-stepped until it grew late. My father said I should ride my bike home, and I did, wobbling into the yard. I took Pearl up to my room and was just falling asleep when I heard my parents coming home. I heard them walk up the stairs talking together in low voices, and then I heard them enter their bedroom, the way they always had before. I heard them shut their door with that final small click that meant everything was safe and good. If things could stay that way, safe and good, if the attacker would die in jail, if he would kill himself, I couldn't live with the if. I need to know, I said to my father the next morning. You got to tell me what the carcass looks like. I'll tell you when I can, Joe. Does Mom know he could get out? My father waved his finger across his lips. Not exactly, no. Well, yes, but we haven't spoken. It would set her back, he said quickly. His face contorted. He put his hand over his features as if to erase them. I have to look out for her, watch for him. He nodded, and after a while he rose, and with a heavy tread walked to his desk. As he fumbled in his pocket for his keys, I saw the vulnerable brown eggshell of his head, the wisps of white. He had begun to lock this particular drawer, but now he opened it and withdrew a file. He opened the file, walked over to me, and drew out a photograph, a mugshot. He put the photograph in my hands. Your mother hasn't decided whether to tell anybody else, he said. It's her call, so don't talk about this. A handsome but not good-looking, powerful man with a pallid complexion and black shining eyes that showed no white, just the speck of livid life. His half-open mouth was filled with perfect white teeth, and his lips were thin and red. It was the customer. The man who'd bought gas the day before I quit. I seen him before, I said. Lyndon Lark. He bought gas at Whitey's. My father didn't look at me, but his jaw flattened. His lips went hard. When? Must have been just before he was picked up. My father pinched the picture back and slid it into the file. I could see that it hurt his fingers to touch the photograph, that the mute image emitted a jagged force. He slammed the file back in the drawer, then stood staring at the papers scattered over his desk. He unclenched the hand over his heart, opened it, fingered a shirt button. Bought gas at Whitey's? We heard my mother outside. She was pounding slim poles she'd cut down into the ground, setting them alongside her tomato plants. Next, she would rip old sheets into strips to bind their acrid, musky stems, so that they could safely climb. Already the plants bore star-shaped flowers colored a soft, bitter yellow. He studied us, said my father softly. Knows we can't hold him. Thinks he can get away. Like his uncle. What do you mean? The lynching. You know that. Old history, Dad. Lark's great uncle was in the lynching party. Thus, I think, the contempt. I wonder if he even knows how people here kept track of that, I said. We know the families of the men who were hanged. We know the families of the men who hanged them. We even know our people were innocent of the crime they were hung for. A local historian has dredged that up and proved it. Outside, my mother was putting away the tools. They jangled in her bucket. She cranked on the hose and began to spray her garden, the water splattering softly back and forth. We'll get him anyway, I said. Won't we, Dad? But he was staring at his desk, as if he saw through the oak top into the file beneath it, and through the manila cover to the photograph, and from the photograph perhaps to some other photograph, or record of old brutality that hadn't yet bled itself out. After his mother died, Lyndon Lark had kept her farmhouse at the edge of Hoopdance. He had been staying in the house, a rickety, peeling two-story that once had flower beds and big vegetable gardens. Now, of course, The whole place had gone to weeds and was cut off by crime tape. Dogs had searched and double-searched the premises, the fields and woods surrounding the house, and found nothing. "No, Mela," I said. Dad was talking with me later on that day. The house was quiet. I'd been playing my game. He'd walked in. This time he told me things. The governor of South Dakota had stated that the child he wished to adopt came from a Rapid City social service agency, and that claim was confirmed. The people there said about a month ago someone, a man it was believed, had left the baby asleep in her car seat in the furniture section at Goodwill. There had been a note pinned on the baby's jacket informing the finder that her parents were dead. "Is it Mela's baby?" My father nodded. "Your mother was shown a picture. She identified the baby." "Where is Mom now?" I asked. My father raised his brows, still surprised. "I just dropped her off at work." A few days after my mother identified the baby, she began regular hours at her office. There was a backlog, blood quantum to parse, genealogy hopefuls curious about their possible romantic Indian princess grandmothers. There were children returning as adults, adopted out people, cut off from the tribe, basically stolen by the state welfare agencies. And there were also those who had given up on being an Indian, but whose children longed for the connection and designed a meaningful family vacation to the reservation to explore their heritage. She had a lot to do, and this was even before casino money roped wannabes in droves. She could apparently work as long as Lark was in custody, as long as the baby was safe. There were a few days when things were normal. But it was holding your breath normal. We heard the baby was with her grandparents, George and Aurora Wolfskin. She was placed there permanently, or at least until Mela returned, if she did return. Then about the fourth day, my mother told my father that she had to talk to Gabir Olson and Special Agent Bierke, because now that the baby's safety was no longer an issue, she'd suddenly remembered the whereabouts of that missing file. "All right," my father said. "Where?" "Where I left it, underneath the front seat of the car." My father went outside and came back with the manila folder in his hand. They went to Bismarck again, and I stayed with Clements and Edward. The birthday banners were all down, the beer cans crushed. The leaves were dried out in the arbor. Things again were quiet at Clements's and Edward's house, but a sort of cheerful quiet, as there were always people coming around to visit. Not only relations and friends, but people who came just for Moosham, students or professors. They would set up a tape recorder and tape him talking about the old days or speaking Michif or Ojibwe, or Cree, or all three languages together. But he really didn't tell them much. All his real stories came at night. I slept in Evie's room with him. About an hour or two into the night, I woke to hear him talking. The Roundhouse. "When he was told to kill his mother," said Nana Push, "a great rift opened in his heart. There was a crack so deep it went down forever. On the before side, his love for his father and belief in all that his father did lay crumpled and discarded. And not only did one belief, but others as well. It was true that there could be a Windogog, people who lost all human compunction in hungry times and craved the flesh of others. But people could also be falsely accused. The cure for a Wendigo was often simple. Large quantities of hot soup. No one had tried the soup on a key. No one had consulted the old and wise. The people he'd loved, including his uncles, had simply turned against his mother, so Nanapush could not believe in them or in what they said or did anymore. On the side of the crack where Nanapush was, however, his younger brothers and sisters, who had cried for their mother, existed. And his mother, too, also the spirit of the old female buffalo who had been his shelter. That old buffalo woman gave Nanapush her views. She told him that he had survived by doing the opposite of all the others. Were they abandoned? He saved. Where they were cruel? He was kind. Were they betrayed? He was faithful. Nanapush then decided that in all things he would be unpredictable. As he had completely lost trust in authority, he decided to stay away from others and to think for himself, even to do the most ridiculous things that occurred to him. "You can go that way," said the old buffalo woman, "but even though you become a fool, people will in time consider you a wise man. They will come to you." Nanapush did not want anyone to come to him. "That will not be possible," said the buffalo woman, "but I can give you something that will help you. Look into your mind and see what I am thinking about." Nanapush looked into his mind and saw a building. He even saw how to make the building. It was the roundhouse. The old female buffalo kept talking. "Your people were brought together by us buffalo once. You knew how to hunt and use us. Your clans gave you laws. You had many rules by which you operated, rules that respected us and forced you to work together. Now we are gone. But as you have once sheltered in my body, so now you understand. The roundhouse will be my body, the poles my ribs, the fire my heart. It will be the body of your mother, and it must be respected the same way, as the mother is intent on her baby's life, so your people should think of their children." "That is how it came about," said Mushim. "I was a young man when the people built it. They followed Nanapush's instructions." I sat up to look at Mushim, but he had turned over and begun his snore. I lay awake thinking of the place on the hill, the holy wind in the grass, and how the structure had cried out to me. I could see a part of something larger, an idea, a truth. But just a fragment. I could not see the whole, but just a shadow of that way of life. I had been there 3 or 4 days when Clements and Uncle Edward went over to Minot to purchase a new freezer. They started out early in the morning, before I was up. Mushim had risen at 6 as usual. He drunk the coffee, eaten all the eggs, toast, and buttered hash brown potatoes that Clements made. Even my share. When I went down to the kitchen, I took a slice of cold meatloaf she'd left for lunch, slapped it between 2 pieces of soft white bread with ketchup. I asked my Mushim what he wanted to do that day, and he looked vague. "You go off with your own," he waved his hand. "I'm all set here." "Clement said I have to stay with you."
"Sah.
She treats me like a puking baby. You go. You go off and have a good time." Then Mushim tottered over to Evie's old dresser and rummaged around the things in his top drawer until he came up with an old gray sock. Dangling the sock at me with a significant look, he plunged his hand in. He was wearing his dentures, which usually meant company. With a sly air of triumph, he drew a soft $10 bill from the toe of the sock and waved it at me. "Take this. Go on. Live it up. Majan." I didn't take the bill. "You're up to something, Mushim." "Up to something," he said. as he sat down, up to something. Then he said in a low outrage, "How can a man be a man?" "Maybe I can help you," I said. "Hey, so be it. Clements keeps my bottle high in the kitchen cabinet. You could fetch me that." It wasn't even noon, but then I figured, what could it hurt? He lived long enough to deserve a drink of whiskey when he wanted it. Clements had given him but one pour on his birthday. Then lots of swamp tea to counteract the effect. I was standing on the countertop trying to find the place where Clements hid the bottle when Sonya came in the back door. She was carrying a plastic shopping bag with sturdy handles, and at first I thought she shopped again with my money and was coming to show Clements her purchases. I clambered down with the bottle in my hand and said in a belligerent tone, "So you went on another spending spree?" I stood before her. "We going to dig up those passbooks?" I said. "We're going to go around and get all that money back, Sonya." "All right," she said, her blue eyes soft with hurt. "That's fine. Stop this talk of money." Musham stumbled close to Sonya, took her arm. He spoke silkily. "This old man has money and a bottle, too. Ma chérie, Nini Musham." Musham steered Sonya and her heavy shopping bag toward the bedroom. "Get out of here now," he said to me. "Get!" He held his hand out for the bottle. But I stood my ground. "I'm not going anywhere," I said. "Clements told me to stay." I followed them into the bedroom. They stared at me in a helpless way. I sat down on the bed. "I'm not leaving, at least until I see what's in that bag." Musham gave me an outraged snort. He snatched the bottle from my hand and took a quick pull. Sonya sat down sullenly and puffed out her lips. She was wearing one of her tracksuits, plush and pink, and a T-shirt with a plunging neckline. A silver heart at the end of a silver chain pointed to the shadowy swelling line, where her breasts were pushed together. Her hair glowed in light from the window behind her. "Joe," she said, "this is Musham's birthday present." "What is?" "What's in the bag?" "Well, I'll give it to him then. It's a grown-up gift." "A grown-up gift?" Sonya made a face that meant, "Duh." My throat shut. I looked from Musham to Sonya, back and forth. They wouldn't look at each other. "I'm going to ask you to leave in a nice way, Joe." But as she spoke, she started taking things from the bag. Not exactly clothes. Tatters of cloth and sequiny things and glittering tassels and some long strands of hair and fur. Heeled sandals with long leather laces. I'd seen this stuff before on her. In my folder labeled homework. "I'm not leaving." I sat down next to Musham on his low cot. "You are, too," Sonya stared at me. "Joe?" Her face hardened in a way I had not seen before. "Get out of here," she ordered. "I won't," I said. "No," she stood, hands on her hips, and puffed air into her cheeks, mad. I was mad, too. But what I said surprised me. "You're going to let me stay, because if you don't, I'll tell Whitey about the money." Sonya froze and sat back down. She was holding some shiny cloth. She stared at me. A remote, mystified look crept onto her face. A shiny film flooded her eyes, making her look so young. "Really?" she said. Her voice was sad, a whisper. "Really?" I should have left right then. In one half hour, I wish I'd had, but also be glad I stayed. I've never felt all one way about what happened next. "Money again, saw," cried Musham in disgust, which made me think about the money and about Sonya's diamond earrings. I grabbed Musham's bottle and drank. The whiskey hit me, and my eyes watered, too. "He's a good boy," said Mushum. Sonya wouldn't take her eyes off me. "You think so? You really think he's a good boy?" She sat down and slapped the shiny bra she held against her knee. "He takes good care of me," Mushum drank and offered me the bottle again. I passed it to Sonya. "You'll tell Whitey, huh?" She gave me an ugly smile, a smile that jolted me. Then she knocked back a long swallow. Mushum took a sip and handed the bottle back to me. Sonya narrowed her eyes until the blueness turned black. "So it's you and Whitey, okay then? I'm on a dress in the bathroom. You boys stay right here. And if you ever say a word about anything to anybody, Joe, I will cut off your puny dick." My jaw dropped, and she laughed mean. "Can't have it both ways, you lying little phony. I'm not momming you anymore." She took a tape player out of the bottom of her bag, plugged it into the wall, and popped in a cassette. "When I come back in, turn the music on," she ordered. Then she went across the hall to the bathroom with her bag. Mushum and I sat silently on the cot. I now remembered the two of them talking low at the party and how they had annoyed me. My head started buzzing. I took another swig from Mushum's bottle. After a while, Sonya came back in, shut the door behind her and locked it, then turned around. I suppose the two of us gaped at her. "Hit play, Joel," she growled. The music began, a low, faraway series of wails and chants. Sonya's hair was held straight up in a metallic cone that acted as a fountain, spilling tons of hair, more than she really had, down her shoulders and back. She wore heavy makeup. Her eyebrows were black wings, her lips a cruel red, a formal gray sheath of silk hung from her neck to her legs and covered her arms. She drew a long, wavy dagger from her sleeve. Then she lifted her arms like an ancient goddess about to sacrifice a goat or a live man tied on a slab of rock. She held the dagger in both hands, then switched to one hand, staring at the dagger. She pushed an invisible switch. The dagger lit up and glowed. The music changed to guttural, grinding moans, then a sudden series of yips. Along with each yip, she cut apart a piece of Velcro that held her robe together. She teased us for a while. The robe had slits in the sides. One armor-plated breast would appear, a leg in the sandal laced to her thigh. Finally, after a chorus of chants and howls, there was a sudden shriek. Then silent. She dropped her robes. I grabbed Mushum's arm. I didn't want to waste a second looking at him, but didn't want him to fall over backward either and hit his head. I have never, ever forgotten her in the dim glory of Evie's bedroom. She was tall in those heeled sandals. With her hair in that cone, she nearly touched the ceiling. Her legs went up forever, and she wore a bikini bottom that looked like it was forged of iron, padlocked shut. Her stomach was pure and lithe, toned I don't know how. I'd never seen her exercise. And my loves, her breasts, also cased in bits of plastic armor, pushed at the seams of the breastplate, which had been made with fake erect nipples. Skins and scarves flowed off her. She held the dagger in her teeth, and she began to rub and work the fur and fabric all over her body. She wore thin vinyl gauntlets. She took one off, lightly whipped herself and scoured her chastity belt with it, and then cracked me across the face. I almost fainted. I grabbed Mushum again. He was panting with happiness. Sonya smacked me right in the eye with the other gauntlet. The drums began. Sonya's belly and hips began to gyrate in a different tempo. So fast her movements blurred. Mushum gave me the bottle. I choked. Sonia whirled, kicked me in the knee. I bent over in pain, but my eyes never left her. The drum fell silent. She played with the leather strips that held her armor bra together, and then suddenly she let it drop. And there they were, wearing only gold tassels that she twirled first one way, then the other, mesmerizing us. I was dizzy by the time the drum quit. Mushim's breath came ragged. I could hear the tape scratch. She pulled the ties on her sandals, stepped out of them, threw them at my head. She unsnapped the cone from her hair, and it fell around her face in a wild waterfall. She threw the cone at me, too. Barefoot, she stepped close and began to grind her hips to the howls of wolves. But when she reached down into her iron bikini and slowly pulled out a key on a silken string, Mushim was ready. He snatched the key from her fingers, and without a tremble in his ancient fist, he opened the padlock, unhooked and threw it to the side. And there was a G-string made of soft, black, dense fur. Well, it was a rabbit pelt, but so what? She straddled Mushim's lap, but carefully did not let down her weight, cupped her tasseled breasts in her hands. "Happy birthday, old man," she said. Mushim's smile glowed. Tears flowed down the grooves in his cheeks. He put his arms around her waist, rested his forehead between her breasts, and took one deep groaning breath. He did not take another. "Oh, no." Sonia lifted her arms away and lowered him cautiously onto his cot. She put her ear to his chest and listened. "I can't hear his heart," she said. I held on to Mushim, too. "Should we do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation? CPR? What? Sonia?" "I don't know." We looked down at him. His eyes were closed. He was smiling. He looked the happiest I'd seen him. "He's in a dream now," Sonia said tenderly. Her words burst through a sob. "He's going away. Let's not disturb him." She leaned over Mushim, smoothing his hair back and murmuring. He opened his eyes once, smiled at her, closed his eyes again. "Maybe his heart is beating after all." Sonia knelt down and put her ear to his chest again, biting on her lip. "I hear a thump or two," she said, relieved. Dazed, I watched Mushim for signs of life. But he did not stir. "Pick my stuff up," said Sonia, her head still on Mushim's chest. "Yes," she said, "there's a beat. They're just coming really slow. And I think he took a breath." I went around the room, picking up her things, took them into the bathroom and put them in the shopping bag. I brought the tracksuit and tennis shoes into the bedroom and turned my back as she put them on. I wouldn't look at her. When she was all dressed, she picked up the shopping bag holding her stripper outfit and dropped it at my feet. "Keep it. Jerk off in it. I don't care," she said. She plucked the fallen tassel I'd missed off the floor and threw it in my face. "I'm really sorry," I said. "Sorry doesn't cut it, but I couldn't care less. You know where I'm from." "No." "Outside Duluth. That's a nice town, right?" "Yeah, I guess." "I went to a Catholic school. I finished 8th grade. Know how I made it through?" "No." My mom was a Catholic, yeah. She went to church. She worked the boats. Know what she did?" "No." "She went with men, Joe. Know what that means?" I mumbled something. "That's how I came along in the first place. She tried to keep her own money, too. Know what that means, Joe?" "No." "She got beat up a lot. She took drugs, too. And guess what? I never met my dad. I never saw him. But my mom was good to me, sometimes, sometimes not, whatever. I quit school, had my baby. I did not learn nothing, anything. My mom said if you got nothing, you can strip, just dance around, right? Don't do nothing more, just dance around. I had a friend, she was doing it, making money. I said yes. I wouldn't do any other stuff. Think I did something else? No. I got stuck in that life. Then I met Whitey, see? They opened up more bars for dancing during the hunting season. Whitey courted me, followed me around the circuit. Whitey started protecting me. He asked me to quit. Come live with me, he says. I didn't ask if he would marry me. You know why, Joe? No. I'll tell you. I didn't think I was worth marrying, that's why. Not worth marrying. Why should even an over-the-hill Elvis with a bridge for teeth, an old guy no more educated than me, a drunk who hits me, why should even a guy like that marry me, huh?
I don't know, I thought.
You thought we were married. Well, no. Whitey did not do me that honor. Though I got a cheap ring, I don't give a rat's ass now. And you, I treated you good, didn't I?
Yes.
But all along, you were itching, sneaking a good lick at my tits when you thought I didn't know. You think I didn't notice?
My face was so red and hot that my skin burned.
Yeah, I noticed, said Sonya. Take a good look now, close up, see this?
I couldn't look.
Open your freaking eyes.
I looked. A thin white scar ran up the side and around the nipple of her left breast.
My manager did that with a razor, Joe. I wouldn't take a hunting party. Think your threats scare me?
No.
Yeah, no. You're crying, aren't you? Cry all you want, Joe. Lots of men cry after they do something nasty to a woman. I don't have a daughter anymore.
I thought of you like my son. But you just turned into another piece of shit guy. Another gimme-gimme asshole, Joe. It's all you are. Sonya left. I sat with Mushim. Time collapsed. My head rang like I'd been clocked. Sometimes with the ancient, their breath comes so shallow it cannot be discerned. The afternoon went on, and the air went blue before he finally stirred. His eyes opened and then closed. I ran for water and gave him a little sip. "I'm still here," he said. His voice was faint with disappointment. I continued to sit with Mushim at the edge of his cot, thinking about his wish for a happy death. I'd had a chance to see about the difference between Sonya's right and left breasts, but I wished I'd never had. Yet I was glad I did. The conflict in me skewed my brain. About 15 minutes before Clements and Edward returned with the freezer, I looked down at my feet and noticed the golden tassel by the leg of the cot. I picked it up and put it in my jeans pocket. I don't keep the tassel in a special box or anything anymore. It's in the top drawer of my dresser, where things just end up, like Mushim's limp stray sock where he kept money. If my wife has ever noticed that I have it, she said nothing. I never told her about Sonya, not really. I didn't tell her how I stuffed the rest of Sonya's costume in a garbage can by the tribal offices where the BIA was contracted to pick it up. She wouldn't know that I put that souvenir tassel where I'd come across it by chance on purpose. Because every time I look at it, I am reminded of the way I treated Sonya, and about the way she treated me, or about how I threatened her, and all that came of it, how I was just another guy. How that killed me once I really thought about it. A gimme gimme asshole. Maybe I was. Still, after I thought about it for a long time, in fact, all my life, I wanted to be something better. Doe had built a little deck onto the front of the house, and it was filled, as all of our decks tend to be, with useful refuse. There were snow tires stored in black garbage bags, rusted jacks, a bent hibachi grill, banged-up tools and plastic toys. Cappy slumped amid all that jetsam in a sagging lawn chair. He was running both hands over his hair as he stared at the dog-scratched boards. He didn't even look up when I stepped next to him and sat down on an old picnic bench. "Hey!" Cappy didn't react. "So, Anine!" Still nothing. After a lot more nothing, it came out that Zelia had gone back to Helena with the church group, which I already knew. And after still more nothing, Cappy blurted out, "Me and Zelia, we did something." "Something? We did everything."
"Everything?"
"Everything we could think of. Well, there might be more, but we tried."
"Where?"
"In the graveyard. It was the night of your Mushum's birthday. And once we did a few things there..."
"On a grave?"
"I don't know. We were kind of on the outskirts of the graves, off to the sides, not right on a grave."
"That's good. Could be bad luck, for sure."
"Then after, we got into the church basement. We did it a couple more times there."
"What?"
"In the catechism room. There's a rug."
I was silent. My head swam. "Bold move," I said at last.
"Yeah, then she left. I can't do nothing. I hurt." Cappy looked at me like a dying dog. He tapped his chest and whispered, "It hurts right here."
"Women," I said.
He looked at me.
"They'll kill you."
"How do you know?"
I didn't answer. His love for Zelia was not like my love for Sonya, which had become a thing contaminated by humiliation, treachery, and even bigger waves of feeling that tore me up and threw me down. By contrast, Cappy's love was pure. His love was just starting to manifest. Elwin had a tattoo gun and traded for his work. Cappy said he wanted to go to his place and get Elwin to etch Zelia's name in bold letters across his chest.
"No," I said. "Come on, don't do that."
He stood. "I'm gonna." I only convinced him to wait by telling him that when his pecs swelled from his workouts, the letters could be bigger. We sat a long time, me trying to distract Cappy, that not working. I finally left when Doe came home and told Cappy to get to work on the woodpile. Cappy walked over to the axe, grabbed it, and began splitting wood with such crazed thwacks that I feared he would take off his leg. I told him to take it easy, but he just gave me a dead look and hit a piece of wood so hard it shot up 10 feet. Meandering back toward our house, where my mother and father were supposed to have returned that afternoon, I had that feeling again of not wanting to go home. But I didn't want to go back to anywhere Sonya was either. Thinking of her made me think of everything. Into my mind there came the picture of that scrap of blue and white checked cloth, and the knowledge I kept pushing away about the doll being in that car. By throwing out the doll, I obviously destroyed evidence, maybe even something that would tell Mela's whereabouts, where she lay, in a place so obscure that even the dogs could not find her. I put the thought of Mela from my mind, and Sonya. I tried also not to think of my mother, of what had maybe happened in Bismarck. All of these thoughts were reasons I did not want to go home or to be alone. They came up over me, shrouding my mind, covering my heart.
Even as I rode, I tried to get rid of my thoughts by taking my bicycle over the dirt hills behind the hospital. I began to course violently up and down, jumping so high that when I landed my bones jarred, whirling, skidding, raising clouds of grit that filled my mouth until I was sick and thirsty and